This is the day of the month that we've set aside to talk about personal finance. We've been doing this for quite a long time, once a month, always on a Friday, to give you a chance to ask questions about investing and money management. Generally, we have here as our guest David Sinnoh, who teaches in the U of I College of Business. He is away this month, but we have a very able substitute, a guy who has been here on the program also before a number of times to do this very show. Kevin Waspy is here. He's an adjunct lecturer in finance in the U of I College of Business. He teaches courses in financial markets and investments and employee benefits, and was good enough to come and sit in here for the hour with us to do the same kind of program. The idea is here, if you have questions about your own financial situation, your priorities, your goals, you can call in and discuss that with Kevin, and he'll make some suggestions, things that you can think about. Obviously, we want people to get as much information as they possibly can, think very carefully about their financial decisions before they make those decisions. But here's one place you can stop and get some information, ask basic questions, and I know Kevin will do his best to give you an answer. All you have to do is call us, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, it's good to have you here.
Thank you, David. I appreciate the lovely introduction, and I always enjoy being here.
We already have a caller, so let's go right ahead. We will not make them wait. The caller's in Bloomington, Indiana, and it's on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi, Kevin. May I ask you about oil prices? I have heard two opinions on oil prices from the actual mercantile exchange. I heard a trader say, I think they're going to stay up. They're going to stay up higher, maybe above $40 a barrel. Then I heard an economist yesterday say, no, he thinks oil prices will probably range down below $40, maybe between $35 and $40. What do you say?
What would you like me to say? Aren't opinions wonderful?
Yeah.
We all have them, and I don't mean to make light of your question. It's a great question, and, you know, I just got to be dead honest with you. If I knew the answer to that, I'd never have to work for a living, right?
Yeah.
But seriously, I tend to look at the question and put it into a context, because I think that's the only way I can make an intelligent guess, okay? So let me look at the context and think of a long-term trend. In a long-term trend, the next 10, 15, 20 years, I don't think there's much on the horizon that gives me pause to believe that oil prices are going to go down significantly and stay down for any lengthy period. And that's just based on nothing but demand and supply. If we look at the demand for crude oil and all of the various refined products and see the industrialization throughout the world, particularly in China, the demand side of the equation tells me that we're going to be seeing oil prices near these levels as a kind of an average rather than significantly lower than these levels. If you backed off of that and said, what are they going to do tomorrow, next week, next month, or next year, then the jury's out. The only thing I think it's really important to try to make a guess at what it's going to do tomorrow, next week, next month, or next year is if you're a trader. And you know, 1,012 years ago, I started in the business as a trader, and we tried to make short-term guesses daily. That was part of our job. Sometimes we were right, sometimes we were wrong, and on balance, we just tried to pay the rent.
Well, there's this argument. This argument was an interesting argument to me. The oil prices are virtually controlled. They're controlled by OPEC, and to a degree, at least to a quite large degree, OPEC, by pumping more or less oil, can control those prices. And right now, there's a great deal of pressure on engineers and technicians to develop alternate sources of energy than oil. So it seems to me that that OPEC has a considerable interest in holding oil prices low enough not to encourage that those alternate fuel machinery to be developed.
I love what you're saying. It's absolutely spot on. I mean, what you've recognized is the circumstance of most of the supply of this commodity is controlled by the OPEC nations. they really have an oligopic situation. You know, the wonderful science of economics tells us exactly that. I mean, they have to be careful managing a price where they actually control supply of a good. And they are concerned. If they push the price too high, they know darn good and well people will try to faster get to an alternative energy source than slower. And this is what they've been doing ever since 1974. Aside from the occasional political squabbles between those countries, I mean, there's no question that that's their playbook. Just like any other oligopic situation where you have that happening. So not to call the OPEC nations a bunch of drug pushers, but the drug pushers got to realize that the price of the product has got to be affordable to the customer. Otherwise, that customer is going to do something to get away from it. So that's it. You're absolutely right. I can see that working in, whether it's a price of oil today, a price of oil 10 years from today, or, you know, a price of oil 10 years ago, until or unless there is a really viable economic substitute, that's going to be the situation.
Well, thank you very much.
All right,
thank you.
I guess there also is another unknown that people, I think, are starting now to talk a little bit about, and that is what is the world oil supply? And I think there are some people who make this argument that says that we may be at or near the peak. That doesn't mean that oil's going to run out next week, but what it means is that we've gotten to the oil that's easy to get, we've got. And we're going to come to the point where it's going to be much more difficult. There may indeed be additional oil out there, but it's going to be harder to recover. It's going to be more expensive to recover. So there you would have to expect the price would have to go up if it's going to cost you more to get it. So if you're talking about 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, that's something, that's a number that you have to put into your equation, but I'm not sure that it's a number that anybody actually has.
Right. I agree with that very much, and it's a little bit of a moving target, too, because depending upon, and I'm no geologist, so I'm out of my area here, but I will tell you that I've been involved in, you know, the study of the energy business for 20-plus years. I've been an investor in the area for 20 plus years, and this is an interesting topic, and you know, obviously when you look back to the history of petroleum in this country or anywhere else, I mean, the ground is not oozing the oil as it once was in Titusville, Pennsylvania. So obviously the easiest oil has been gotten, it's been collected, it's been used. Every time there's a major find, though, that brings what is now a known quantity into a larger number. So I doubt there are any geologists who, like a market person such as myself, would be comfortable forecasting what will be found tomorrow. That's the nature of oil exploration and all the seismic work that's done, and then obviously all the exploratory drilling that goes on. There are some that obviously believe that there are untapped resources and great potential in the Arctic Circle, and obviously the environmental issues that go along with developing or exploiting that carry an economic cost that we have to factor in too. So bottom line is, yes, we've obviously seen over the past 150 years, easy oil is gone. Is the supply of oil a limited factor? Yeah, we live on a closed system here in the Earth, I guess. But what has been discovered and what may be discovered in the future, I think, are still wild cards. I'm not forecasting the desire I have to consume oil at the rate we consume it for the next 450 years. I think finding alternatives to oil is a great thing that we should try to do more of.
Yeah. Our guest here this morning is Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in finance at the U of I College of Business. This is our monthly show on personal finance. You have economic questions, I know he'll do his best. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, folks. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Des Plaines, and that's line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
I'd like to ask a question in a different area, if I may.
Sure.
Sure.
My wife and I are considering a purchase of a home in Michigan would be a summer home. I was wondering if you personally or you had some knowledge where I could get some real good statistics as to what that market's like, and as well as where I might find some independent statistics that I could study to see whether that's feasible for us. Do you have any thoughts on second homes in general?
In general, perhaps. Maybe we could come back to that, but maybe to the specifics of your question. If you and your wife feel like you're attracted to a certain area in Michigan, you kind of, you know, have zeroed it down to a number of little communities, I would say the best thing to do would be to contact the Chamber of Commerce in those towns and ask them those types of information. Local realty firms are going to have a real good handle on recent selling prices and a pretty rich history of past selling prices. I know that may not be what you might prefer to be the totally unbiased source, but it's probably the best source of information. And again, the reason I'm suggesting you contact a Chamber of Commerce person rather than an actual realtor is at least you may not necessarily need the attention of a realtor at this point in time.
Yes.
But you just, you know, you're just looking for data.
Yes.
Aside from that, I mean, in more of a national or regional statistic, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis has a rich database on all sorts of things, whether it's the prices of commodities in general or specific interest rates, a real rich database of history. So the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis, you know, could give you an overall picture and maybe even a regional picture on the cost of housing. But again, if you feel like you're really attracted to Holland, Michigan, and I mean, I know how beautiful that area is. It's a great area. If you're interested, then go with the Chamber of Commerce and see what they can dig up for you.
Okay, well, that's a good lead. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right, thank you. And on again, back here locally to someone in Urbana. This would be line number two. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Morning.
I have a business question, a contemporary news item. Please explain to me why Martha Stewart's being put on the sacrificial altar, and the folks at L. Ron, we never hear anything about, and I'll hear your answer or comments off the line. Thank you.
As I understand the news this morning, Martha was sentenced to 5 months incarceration and 5 months, I believe, home incarceration. And if I recall correctly, the charges that she was found guilty of were obstruction of justice and basically lying to federal investigators in a case involving the trading of stock on insider information. So I don't really know if that qualifies as a sacrificial lamb. I didn't see any blood in the streets when Martha came out of the courthouse or not. As it goes to the officials at Enron, my personal opinion is I'd like to see them strung up in the square and lots of blood on the streets from them. But, you know, that's not the way our system works. Sad fact of the matter is you've hit on a topic that's a favorite of mine, and that's corporate misgovernance or corporate governance, if you want to say how it should work correctly. The sad fact of the matter is there's a lot of pigs at the trough, and we've only caught a handful of them, and there's still a lot of pigs that probably need to be caught and at least made an example of. So, you know, I'm not into sacrificial lambs, and I don't shed a lot of tears for Martha Stewart, but I agree with you wholeheartedly. There's a tip of an iceberg out there that's a whole big block of stinky ice that really should be melted with a blowtorch. Mm.
One of the big differences between the Martha Stewart case and Enron is that it seemed like the Martha Stewart case, it's pretty straightforward, and there aren't that many players. Enron, it's much bigger and it's more complicated, and you have a federal task force that's been working on that for several years now. And occasionally there is news. Just recently, Ken Lay, who was the CEO of Enron, was indicted. They took him out in cuffs.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, the last big break was when they managed to persuade Ken
Fastow
to who was the chief financial officer, who allegedly was the guy who was responsible for a lot of the snarky accounting, to cooperate. So, and so he's his wife, he and his wife both are going to do jail time. And I think that maybe something like, I don't know, a dozen mid-level people have either been charged or convicted. So over time, that's a story that continues to develop, and people continue to be charged and convicted. And it does get coverage in the business press, but it's also a really complicated story. So, and it doesn't have the kind of appeal that the Martha Stewart story does because of who Martha Stewart is.
Yeah, I think you're really hitting home here. The complication of the deal is certainly a part of it, but we all know how the popular news, the popular press works, even any press, so even the business press. If there's something that can sell newspapers, sell ad time, whatever, has a more shock effect type of thing, it seems like that gets the most attention. Martha obviously is a person who has a lot of name recognition and unfortunately, you know, has gotten a lot of cameras and press and so on and so forth in this situation. What Martha did in terms of you know, the charges found guilty of, as compared to someone at a level, whether it's Enron, WorldCom, or whatever. I think it's a pittance. I think, you know, what Martha did was wrong. She probably should have been punished for it if indeed she did it. I guess a jury found her guilty, so we could conclude that she did. But the bottom line is the damage done to an economy, the damage done to a financial system, the damage done to any other people pales in comparison to what some of these other pigs have done. And I say other pigs, and probably shouldn't say it that strongly. That's not very professional of me, and may offend some of the swine that are four-legged hogs as we see them out in the fields. But these people all have one character flaw, in my opinion. I'm no psychologist, but I mean, when I look at it and I say to myself, why would somebody do these kinds of things? They were already being paid annual salaries that were 7, 8, and 9 figures annually. And I guess I come to the conclusion, because I'm a real simple person, I'm simple. The conclusion I come to is the character flaw in all of these people is they cannot answer to the question, how much is enough? So if it's Dennis Kozlowski having Tyco corporate monies buying multiple million-dollar condos for his personal use in New York City and then furnishing them with multiple $1 million of artworks, again, at corporate expense. You know what? Dennis just forgot that the corporate money belongs to all of the owners of the company, and it's not just his personal money. If Dennis owned the company, lock, stock, and barrel, he might have been able to do that with impunity, but he didn't. And again, I get back to the how much is enough? Do you need a $5,000 shower curtain? And if you're being paid $110 million a year base salary, you can't afford to buy it yourself. You have to have the company buy it. I mean, that's what I mean by pigs. So again, that's not a very professional thing of me to say, but sometimes it's really good just to call a spade a spade.
Yeah. Our guest here this morning is Kevin Wasby. He's lecturer in finance at U of I College of Business. His opinions are his own, ladies and gentlemen. He is not speaking for the College of Business. This is the program. Once a month, we set aside to talk about personal finance. So if you have questions, particularly if it has to do with your own, you know, you're thinking of your own financial planning strategy and whatever your goals are, you're thinking about buying a home, you're thinking about making sure you want to send your kids to college, you're thinking about planning for your retirement, you have those kinds of nuts and bolts questions, Kevin will see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller in Indiana is next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Here. To a financial question, though. $10,000. Want to make sure I can get to it if necessary, you know, sort of in a moment's notice. What can I do with it to earn a little interest? And I'm not real concerned in making a big pile of money or anything like that. I just want to have it safe. I've concerned that inflation over a period of time, I'm talking like, you know, the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do with $10,000 under the restrictions that if something happened, I'm sort of the younger member of an older set of a family, and it says, you know, last week an aunt died, and I'm expected to come in to take care of a lot of things, so there may be a period where I'll need that $10,000 or a good part of it immediately. And I don't know a heck of a lot about CDs. I know they don't pay much interest. I know there's a penalty if you take them out early, but I presume that's just on the interest and not on the principal. But I need some sort of information, to the place of, you know, put in a safe box and hide it out in the backyard, you know, to any other kind of investment that would be a peculiar, you know, particularly safe. I just want to make sure the principal's there when I need it.
Sure, sure. Your question is a good question. It's a good, very basic question. It's something that, I guess is a great place to begin with whenever we talk about the process of investing, because what you've hit on is a very common standard, don't ever forget it type of relationship. The higher return a person expects to have, the more risk they're going to have to be comfortable accepting. And you've looked at it and you've assessed the need for the money is potentially near term. You've looked at it and you've said, I can't afford to lose the principal amount. And that tells me that the risk that you can assume, obviously, is very limited. You've concerned yourself with some amount of liquidity, too. So let's go down one of two paths. Certificates of deposit at your local bank or credit union are certainly things that you should be looking at. A certificate of deposit is a guaranteed deposit, meaning that some agency of the federal government is going to guarantee the money be there even if the financial institution gets into trouble and goes away. They do carry fixed terms, meaning if I went down to a bank or credit union, I could arrange a certificate of deposit for a time of 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, perhaps out as far as 5 years in a general, usual kind of situation. And with any amount of money, even an amount as workable as $10,000, the nice thing about certificates of deposit is you don't have to put all of the money in one maturity. So the suggestion I would make is that you or anyone considering the management of money in a fixed income type of position, which a certificate of deposit fixed income qualifies it at, would do this. Break the money into a number of pieces. Let's use your example of $10,000. Let's break it into five different pieces of $2,000 each, and then put that $2,000 into each maturity of 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, 30 months, 36 months, so on and so forth. What you're doing is building what's called a ladder of maturities, a ladder that we'd picture using to clean our gutters with the different rungs on the ladder that we climb up and climb down. So here's the way it works out. Obviously, with interest rates still near 45-year lows, none of the money is going to be earning a tremendous rate of return. That's just the fact of where we're at now. But still, today, the situation is such that you are paid a higher rate of interest for the longer-term deposit. So the 6 month pays less than the 12 month, the 12 month pays less than the 18 month, so on and so forth. And the way you can look at it is a fifth of your money is going to come due every 6 months. Having the opportunity to reprice at a new longer term instrument. So again, using our example, if I built my ladder over 30 months, a fifth of the money in every 6 months, 6 months will pass. The six-month CD matures. Everything else I still own now has 6 months left to go. I take the $2,000 and the interest that it's earned and go out and buy a new 30-month CD, and I replace that rung on the ladder. So that gets you an opportunity to average interest rates over time. It gets you an opportunity to have access to a fifth of the money every 6 months. It also gets you an opportunity where if interest rates continue to inch higher over the coming years, you will have the opportunity every 6 months to reprice not only at a higher rate of return because the short-term CD matures at a low rate and you're buying another instrument at a longer term at a higher rate, but this is what I call the bonus season. So if interest rates as a trend in the marketplace have moved higher, you're not only going to renew a now maturing 6 month CD at a 30-month rate, but you'll renew it at a higher 30-month rate. Does that make sense?
No, the caller rung off, so I'm hoping that he's still listening.
Okay.
It sounds It makes sense to me. So that's one way of doing it.
So a ladder of maturity is a time-worn, time-tested method. It's a very simple but very powerful tool a person can use to manage fixed income investments. The other path that I mentioned that a person may want to pursue, and this is probably not as sensible with an amount such as $10,000, but still possible in some cases, and that is U.S. Treasury securities, U.S. Treasury bills, notes and bonds sold directly by the government, guaranteed by the government. Those are available in smaller denominations. We can buy them direct from the Treasury with what's called a Treasury Direct Account. Excuse me. And we can invest in those rather than CDs. And I guess the benefit in doing that is these are liquid instruments. We could sell it tomorrow after having bought it today. The only question is at what price. So the market price of a U.S. Treasury bill, note, or bond varies when interest rates change. They're very liquid instruments, but the price is a variability. The CD, of course, has no pricing issues. It is a contract with the bank or the credit union, and it's liquid in a sense of saying, if you break the term of the CD, if you need the money out prior to the actual maturity date, in most instances you will have to pay a penalty, and the penalty will be 3 months of interest that the certificate would have earned. So again, it's not a huge penalty. It's not like you're surrendering a part of your money, but it is the way certificates of deposit work. And that's in lieu of having the liquidity of a U.S. Treasury bill, note, or bond, but the uncertainty in that liquidity of at what price will I sell it.
Yeah. There are, of course, opportunities to you could, now depending on how much interest you were expecting, obviously you could simply open a checking account that paid interest. There are some banks that will offer particular kinds of investment accounts. Minimums may be required, but mm-hmm. particular kind of investment accounts where they say, okay, for this much money, we're going to give you this much interest, and then we will allow you a limited check writing possibility. So say you put in at least $10,000 and we'll pay you this much interest, and every month we'll let you write 3 checks.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be something where, again, it's insured. There's interest. It may not be as good as you get with a CD,
mm-hmm.
But if you needed the money right now, you could actually, and they'll give you a checkbook, and
right.
you can actually sit down and just and simply write a check for it.
Right, if a person knows that this money is literally going to be needed, then obviously a transactions type of an account like that, or a passbook savings account that so many of us have forgotten about. That's how we probably started a relationship with a bank 40 years ago. We opened up a passbook savings account, and any time we went into the bank, we could have any or all of it back at any time, and as long as it was there, it was earning some rate of interest. So, those are very good tools for liquidity type of accounts, transaction type of accounts where we need access to the money.
Yeah, the only downside of those is that probably the interest rate is not going to be very attractive.
Yeah, the interest rate's always going to be less than any fixed-term investment, and again, it's simply because the institution knows that you can come in tomorrow and what they can do with those funds as opposed to what they could do with a promise of leaving the money there 6, 12, or 18 months is different.
Yeah. A little bit past the midpoint here, our guest is Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in finance at the U of I College of Business. This is our regular monthly show on personal finance. If you have questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
All right. I'd like to ask about two things. The first thing is real interest rates, and the second thing is going to be non-U.S. assets. And by that, I mean both foreign currencies and stocks and bonds and also commodities. Not that those are foreign, but just that they're global. So basically, the impression I get is that we've got the U.S. money supply has been increasing pretty fast for a long time now as part of this reflation effort, and you've got interest rates have been held down for a long time, and so bonds are probably just about as high as they're going to be for quite some time. And then also, if you look at price to earning ratios of U.S. stocks, over the last couple of decades, they've been, you know, this a big part of the stock market been going up has been just that the prices have been going up, but the earnings haven't. And so it just seems to me like stock prices are overinflated. And if you look at the U.S. dollar, bond prices are overinflated because interest rates are so low. And then the U.S. dollar, you have the money supply going up, which should devalue the dollar. And then you got these huge federal deficits and debts, and that also has to be paid off, which would bring the dollar down. So my two questions are, shouldn't interest rates be going a lot higher one of these days, and which argues against bonds? And then second of all, shouldn't the dollar be coming down? The dollar, basically all U.S. assets, and shouldn't things like foreign currencies and foreign stocks and bonds and commodities being going up higher?
Yeah, I think we've probably seen a little bit of that happening already. Obviously, if you follow the exchange rates between different currencies, the U.S. dollar has declined significantly against the euro, the yen, or any other major currency that you want to look at. The economic policy in this country has been for the past two and a half years to try to reflate it, try to get it to grow a little bit faster than what it had been. We fell off kind of a heck of a cliff at the end of the 1990s, and now they're trying to, they have been trying to get us a little bit more back to business, so to speak. I agree with you in terms of bonds right now. We are still, even though interest rates have risen from where they were, say, a year ago at this time, we are still very near 45-year lows in the cycle of interest rates. People need to remember that when they buy a fixed income investment, a bond, that the price of the bond, the value of it, varies inversely with interest rates, which means to say if interest rates rise after I buy a bond, the value of it will drop. So I'm not advocating that a person go out and buy long-term fixed income investments right now. That would just seem to be the wrong time of the cycle to be doing it in. So let's get to the basics and try to answer your question. For a person who has an investment need and wants to try to insulate themselves from either currency and or inflation potential, I think the U.S. Treasury gives us an excellent tool to do that with, and that's a Treasury Inflation Protected Security, better known as TIPS, U.S. Treasury securities that are auctioned, sold by the U.S. government. They pay a nominal, low, fixed rate of interest, but every 6 months, the principal amount is adjusted. It's increased based on an index of inflation. So if you were concerned about purchasing power of your money over a longer period of time, 10, 15, 20 years, TIPS make terrific investment opportunities. So I'd look there first. Unless we're talking huge sums of money, I'd stay away from things that are commodities themselves, and I would stay away from currencies themselves. Again, unless you're a trader or unless you're talking about huge sums of money, the speculation in the value of the euro as opposed to the value of the dollar is just not something that I would call an investment. Instead, I would call it a speculation.
What do you think about the relative, dangerousness or whatever of currencies and commodities versus, say, U.S. stocks?
As compared to buying U.S. stocks, I'm assuming we're talking about, some proven companies. I don't necessarily want to say blue chips, but I want to say not the most recent initial public offering of some whiz-bang company, okay? So if we're talking about the stocks of well-known market leader type companies, I would say the risk level there on a scale of 1 to 10 is about a 4 as compared to commodities, which is about a 15.
Okay. Thanks a lot, and I hope for anybody investing in stocks that's right.
Yeah, I mean, just leave you with one last idea. I'm not big on market timing. Again, my history is one of a trader, and the the opportunities to time markets are you know, there, but it's when it's your business, you're not always right. Okay, so as a person investing their own wealth or just kind of thinking down the line and trying to manage their own wealth, timing is not an issue that is a real big concern, in my opinion. Bottom line is, look at an allocation that makes sense for your circumstance. So in other words, don't tell me that stocks are overpriced and bonds are overpriced, therefore I'm going to go into commodities. Let's just admit that over the long run, sometimes they're going to be overpriced, sometimes they're going to be underpriced. So I just want to hold a reasonable allocation of stocks, bonds, maybe cash at all times. And, you know, it just doesn't take a lot of effort and energy then to look at it over the long run and say, well, there will be periods where one class of assets will reward me and another class of assets won't. And in the long run, it'll come to wash out fairly well.
So you think that in the long run, stocks are going to do better than other assets?
Well, what other assets?
Commodities and currencies.
I think on a risk-adjusted basis, they'll all do commensurate with what they've done in the past. In other words, if you want to assume the riskiness of investing in commodities, quote-unquote, the investment in commodities is probably best done by investing in companies that, you know, I mean, we're talking about the value of an asset based on its importance in an economic situation, its importance in the economy at large. So buying shares of a company is thought to be buying shares in the growth of the economy at large. Buying the assets that we might refer to as commodities, corn, beans, so on and so forth, you know, those are only inputs into end products. I mean, unless I'm a farmer, I'm not going to be real concerned about that because, you know, Archer Daniels Midland is still going to buy corn, whether it's $2 a bushel or $3 a bushel or $4 a bushel, to make what they make out of corn.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, yeah. I guess, you know, there's a lot going on in the markets these days, so I guess there's a lot for any investor to think about.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left here, and let's go on to another caller. This is Champagne, and it's line two. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions also, which you may have answered, but I'll need some help on anyway because I don't always understand it.
Sure.
One of them is I have mutual funds, some money, and, you know, I've been putting my money in mutual funds because I didn't want to lose it. And should I switch now to some CDs?
No.
No. You think the mutual funds...
Did I have to think about that very long?
No, you didn't.
Well, then let me back up and give you the serious answer. If you put the money into a mutual fund that invested in things that you were comfortable with,
yeah.
See, because we've got to peel back the layers on this onion.
Uh-huh.
A mutual fund is a way for you and I to pool smaller amounts of money to put into a variety of assets. So if we bought a mutual fund that buys stocks, then you and I have a pro rata investment in that portfolio of stocks. If that mutual fund bought bonds, then we've got a pro rata investment in a portfolio of bonds. So let's look not only at the fact that you bought a mutual fund or funds, but what they invested in.
I was just wondering, what I did then is whatever they made, I put into an account so I could take the money out if I needed it. Do you know what I mean? I'm not sure I'm explaining myself. All the money that I made or what investment I made went into an account where I could get checks and
mm-hmm.
take money out. So should I take that money it's about $4,000 in this account of my earnings from my investment, should I take that money and put it in CDs or some of it anyway?
Well, if you have no need for that money that's accumulated as distributed money from the mutual fund investment, then I would say that would be a good alternative, something like CDs. Again, thinking about, you know, a ladder of maturities, even with $4,000, you could do that with certificates of deposit. But again, to the root of your question, I guess I'd have to go back and ask, what was the purpose of putting the money in the mutual fund or funds, And then has that purpose changed, or has a circumstance in your life changed that purpose? And then finally, what was it that this mutual fund actually did with the money? So, in other words, if your life circumstances haven't changed, if the purpose is still a valid purpose, and the vehicle, meaning what this investment is in, is still a suitable vehicle, then that's the way, you know, I would try to attack the question, should I pull my money out of this mutual fund?
Okay, now I've got it in some mutual funds, and then I've got it in, it's an RIT, it's a land thing where they buy land and rent out, it's inland.
A REIT?
REIT.
R-E-I-T? Uh-huh.
I think, yes, REIT. Do you think that's still a safe investment? I've got quite a bit of money in that. And that's what I've been drawing off. That investment has been what I've been drawing off to put into this checking account. Do you think that's still a good investment, I guess, is my question.
A real estate investment trust, a REIT, is a way a person can buy into the real estate business, if you want to call it that. And REITs have been extremely good performing asset classes over the past 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
Just like real estate itself has.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of that has to do with the fact that interest rates over the past 3-4 years have fallen like a stone. Now, again, I'm not trying to predict the future, but just kind of looking around and seeing where we're at, would I expect the real estate market to do what it's done over the past 3 or 4 years? In the coming 3 or 4 years, probably not. And that's because would I expect interest rates to continue to fall like a stone over the coming 3 or 4 years like they have over the past 3 or 4 years? I don't think so.
Right.
And again, I'm not trying to make market timing decisions here, mm-hmm. but I get a little bit concerned when a person says, I've got quite a bit of money there.
Yeah.
You see, because here's where I'd like anybody to be at any point in time. The amount of money you have wherever you have it is a portion of all of the money, which means to say that regardless of what happens with any one vehicle, any one REIT, any one mutual fund, any one asset class,
yeah.
it will not change your lifestyle. If you can accomplish that type of an allocation, that type of a diversification, then you've done what I would call a prudent investor's best choice.
So what I had done was take things kind of out of the market and put them into this REIT, and this might be a good time to reallocate.
Well, it's never a bad time to think about a balanced situation, mm-hmm. and even after an asset allocation is done by a person and they're comfortable with the way they have money invested, it's a little bit like visiting your doctor on a regular basis. You ought to revisit your allocation mm-hmm. and look at it, because the very nature of the value of those assets changing will rebalance where your wealth is located. And it's not a bad idea to then at least once annually look at those areas and rebalance. And if you think about it, this makes pretty neat sense too, because rebalancing means you're going to be selling some of those things that have appreciated greatly in value
mm.
and putting it into those areas that may have depreciated or gone down in value. And you know, before I started in the business, Mama told me that if you buy low and sell high, you're going to be pretty happy.
Yes, that's true.
So that's kind of the rebalancing in a nutshell.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We have time certainly maybe for one, possibly two calls if you want to call quick. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in finance at the U of I College of Business. We have had questions obviously from people who are thinking about interest rates and what's going to happen with them. I think it hasn't been very long here. Within the last couple of weeks, there's been some indication from the Fed that they're thinking, yeah, the interest rates will be going up, that maybe this era of pretty attractively low rates. Well, I suppose it depends on what you're doing. If you're buying a house, low rates good. If you're investing, low rates bad. So there seems to be some indication that they're going to go up. What do you think is likely to happen, or what does anybody think is likely to happen?
Yeah, the interest rate game is largely that. I mean, you know, trying to predict the future of interest rates has been called a fool's game by many people a lot more smarter than I am. But bottom line is this. The Federal Reserve System has been signaling very strongly that the interest rates will have to go higher when they see signs that the economy is strengthened enough and the potential for inflation becomes to worry them. The action they took just a couple of weeks ago was the first attempt at coming clean with that signal. In other words, they made the effort. They raised the target rate on Fed funds a quarter of a percentage point. That's an overt action. But again, I mean, the talks that Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve System, has had with Congress regularly for the past 6 months, has told the markets that this is what's going to happen. I mean, this is not brain surgery. And that's the obvious thing. The markets of interest rates have been signaling that for longer than Alan Greenspan has been saying it. And again, daily changes in interest rates or moment-to-moment changes in the market aside, I think the trend is pretty clearly that interest rates will not be going lower in the coming 5 years, but will slowly be working higher.
We have now, see, I said you can call in and quick, and suddenly the phone line's filled up. So we'll see how many people we can get in the time that remains, starting with an Indiana person here. Line four. Hello.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that I'd gotten your mother's advice about house stocks, because I've always bought high and sold low, and that doesn't work very well.
Well, she was a pearl.
But my question goes back to your discussion earlier of Martha Stewart. And just a quick question, and then I'll hang up and listen. But there was a lot of talk about what George Bush did as a board of director member of Harkin Energy, where he had information that the company was in some financial trouble, and before the financial report came out, he sold his stock, and nothing was ever done there. And now he's cracking down, he says, on those who are doing basically the same thing. Could you respond to that, please?
Yeah, just a brief response. I mean, I don't know anything about that, but I also, you know, that's something that's certainly been discussed. It's a shame. And I guess I just put it into the same three-letter word category that I've used already. If that's the fact, it's terrible. It's a darn shame.
That's what we'll give you on that. Let's go to Rabana here, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a quick question about financial planners. My husband and I, now that we have a child, we think that we should be a bit more responsible with our finances, and we've been looking at working with a financial planner. And I've basically found two types. One type is you visit once, you pay a large fee. In this case, it was $500 for this, like, two-hour consultation where the planner leaves you with, like, a plan that you can follow on your own. And then the other kind is more managed financial planning, where the planner takes a percent of however much you invest with, you know, through them. And I wanted to know, do you have any recommendations either way? My husband and I think money makes us nervous, and we don't really know what to do with it. But at the same time, we're fairly intelligent people, and I think we could figure something out if left with a business plan.
Yeah, I would say that a person first needs to be comfortable with the relationship. So, again, to the analogy of your physician, make sure that you have some kind of rapport. To me, it seems rather difficult to establish a rapport in a two-hour meeting where I'm being charged $500. That's just my personal bias.
Yeah.
you know, if you can somehow reasonably establish a rapport without having a king's ransom involved in fees, that's terrific. The bottom line is the advice you get should be good advice regardless of how the person giving it is compensated. Unfortunately, it's a business that's rife with people who like to make quick buck. That doesn't mean that they're all bad. It means that just finding a good one is a little bit, again, like finding a good physician. Ask your friends. ask who they might have worked with, ask for a reference. Just basically, referrals are the best way to find people in this business.
Do you have any recommendations?
Perhaps if we are not talking on the air, that would be the best thing.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, do you, generally speaking, do you like the idea of fee for service over the idea that the person is going to take a percentage of what you end up earning?
It depends. I think you can find either situations to your benefit, depending upon the person you find. So again, there's not a broad 4-inch paintbrush that I'd like to use that says this structure is good, that structure is bad.
Okay. Well, there we'll finish up for this time around with our thanks to Kevin Wasby. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Kevin Wasby, he's a lecturer in finance at the U of I College of Business. And this is a show that we do once a month, giving you an opportunity to ask questions about money management, personal finance, and we'll be doing it again next month.